own wisdom. Let me give you just a few examples of that as we think about King Solomon. It was Solomon who wrote in Psalm 127, in referring to the home and family, unless the Lord builds the house, they labor in vain who build it. And yet Solomon's many families, his house, was not built on these kinds of godly principles that he would talk about later in the same psalm. In 1 Kings chapter 4, it says that Solomon wrote 3,000 proverbs, far more than we have in the book of Proverbs. And yet, as we look through those proverbs, King Solomon violated many of those principles in his own life, from proverbs pertaining to taking care of the poor, to disciplining children, to not aligning yourself too closely with non-believers. They're proverbs, they're wise, but Solomon didn't adhere to them. Do as I say, not as I do. That's basically the book of Ecclesiastes, isn't it? I did this, Solomon says. I couldn't help but think about these things as Kenny was preaching from the book of Ecclesiastes during our meeting. You know, Solomon says, I did this, and I gave my heart to that, and I tried this, and I acquired that. And then Solomon essentially says, after listing all of these things, many of which were sinful, yeah, don't do any of that. It's vanity and striving after the wind. Fear God and keep his commandments. Do as I say, not as I do. To which we might ask, which commandments are we supposed to be doing, Solomon? Like the commandments to kings in Deuteronomy chapter 17, perhaps? Commandments from God through Moses, which say to the king of Israel, you're not supposed to amass horses. Of which 1 Kings chapter 4 says that Solomon had 40,000 horses. Or you're not supposed to amass wives as the king of God's people, of which 1 Kings chapter 11 says he had 700 wives plus 300 more concubines. Or Deuteronomy 17 says you're not supposed to amass silver and gold as the king of Israel, of which 1 Kings chapter 10 says Solomon had so much gold that silver really didn't amount to much. Silver wasn't valuable because there was so much gold that he had. Do as I say, not as I do. Would you agree that that applies to King Solomon? Can I hear your head rattle this way or that way? Absolutely, it does. And all of this is context for properly understanding what Solomon teaches, I believe, in the Song of Solomon about godly love. And so we're going to consider for a few moments this evening this idea of King Solomon and what he teaches about godly love. And I want to suggest something this evening. In our overly sexualized society that is so infatuated with physical beauty and sexual activity of all sorts between all kinds of people in non-marriage environments, the Song of Solomon and its true message of godly love is just the book we need for our day, even if the one who wrote it is actually a man who didn't follow his own wisdom. So turn, if you would, to the Song of Solomon, a book that perhaps you've not heard a lot of sermons out of. Again, we were talking about that some with Kenny over the course of the meeting. But I think it's a song that speaks to our day and age and certainly to believers and our romantic relationships today. The song begins this way. In verse 1, the Song of Songs, which is Solomon's. This is a Hebrew way of saying the greatest of Solomon's songs. It's a Hebrew idiom, like the Holy of Holies, which we would call the most holy place, right? The most holy of all holy places. Or we would call Jesus King of Kings and Lord of Lords, meaning he is the greatest of all kings. He is the Lord over all other lords. And so the natural way to read this beginning of the song is this: that this is the greatest of songs, and Solomon is its author. And I think we only doubt this straightforward understanding, both in the English and in the Hebrew, because of the many different interpretations of the book. So let's ask the question, what is this song really about? Well, the most popular position since the mid-20th century, and really this is a new position in many ways, is that it's a collected of unconnected or very loosely connected poems about love that is a reflection of romantic literature from the time. And maybe Solomon wrote it, maybe he didn't, maybe it's after his style, but it's just this collection of love psalms. Now, to me, this seems unlikely. Though it is perhaps difficult to determine the exact plot line, it seems pretty clear that there is a plot, that there are reoccurring themes that come up over and over in this song. That it is a unified work with these reoccurring characters and poetic devices, certainly that's undeniable. Let me give you an important example of this taken from three different sections of the book. Turn, if you would, to chapter 2, verses 7 and 8. Chapter 2, 7 and 8. Josh, would you mind turning that TV on in the back, if you don't mind? Song of Solomon, chapter 2. Let's look there in verses 7 and 8. She says, "Tell me, you whom my soul loves, where do you pasture your flock? Where do you make it lie down at noon? For why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions? If you do not know, O most beautiful among women, follow the tracks of the flock and pasture your young goats beside the shepherd's tents." And here I am reading the wrong verses. Chapter 2, beginning in verse 7. I'm like, that's not right. Chapter 2, beginning in verse 7. "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. The voice of my beloved, behold, he comes, leaping over the mountains and bounding over the hills." So this is one of the main themes of the book, this idea of not stirring up or awakening love before it pleases. And if we go on later in the book to chapter 3, chapter 3 in verse 5, we see the same words very similarly. "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, by the gazelles or the does of the field, that you do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases." And then again, we see someone coming. Verse 6, "What is that coming up from the wilderness? Like columns of smoke perfumed with myrrh and frankincense, with all the fragrant powders of a merchant." So we have her beloved is coming after this idea of not stirring up love. We have someone else who is coming with pomp and circumstance after this same idea of not stirring up love. And then one more example later in the book, chapter 8, beginning in verse 4. It's kind of presented almost like a choice. You have these two people coming, two very different people coming. And then in verse 4 of chapter 8, "I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Who is that coming up from the wilderness leaning on her beloved?" Which is a symbol in the Middle Eastern world of marriage, leaning on your beloved one. And so there's a choice, and apparently by the end of the book, she has made a choice about that. And in my judgment, it betrays an English bias to read the Song of Songs and read that as a song that includes a bunch of songs, when the idiom, the greatest of songs, is clearly intended. So that's the most recent idea of what this book is about. But historically, you know, the most popular opinion among both Judaism and Christianity is that this is an allegory, perhaps of Christ and the church in Christianity, or of God and Israel in Judaism. And certainly we see other places in the Bible where this idea of God being the husband and his people being the wife are seen in a number of different places. Ephesians chapter 5, for example, might lead us down that path. And we have songs that we sing that are written from this perspective. The Lily of the Valley, Fairest of 10,000 to My Soul, talking about Jesus, taken from the Song of Solomon. Jesus, Rose of Sharon, taken from chapter 2 and verse 1 of Song of Solomon. But again, to me, this seems unlikely. Contrary to popular Christian music, perhaps, or at least some popular Christian music, nowhere else in the Bible is the relationship between Christ and the church portrayed in such overtly sexual terms as what we see in Song of Solomon, at least not in the positive sense. The closest we get are those passages that describe spiritual adultery in the negative sense. And Christ's love for his church and God's love for Israel is sacrificial. It is a sacrificial, multifaceted love and intimacy that is not merely erotic or sexual in nature. The easiest reading, this is kind of the punt, I'm not sure, I guess I'll choose this, is that it was a song written by Solomon, so that's true to the introduction and true to the idea that there is a story here, so it's a song written by Solomon about one of his many wives. And again, I don't just discount this view. One of my favorite professors in college took this view. But I've always been kind of dubious of this particular position. So, if I'm understanding this correctly, Mr. 700 wives and 300 concubines is going to tell us about what true committed love looks like with one out of the 1,000 women. That just doesn't make sense to me. And all those marriages were physical in nature, at least the vast majority of them. The wives were often made because of political alliances that Solomon was making with other kingdoms. And the 300 concubines are what we would call today a harem. And again, it is unlikely in the context of the rest of the Bible that Solomon's love for one of these women would be held up as God's ideal of the marriage relationship. And that's why I think some fight so hard for Solomon not to be the author of this book, no matter that the book starts by identifying him as such, that it must be dedicated to Solomon or in Solomon's style, because it doesn't make sense for Solomon to be the hero of what romantic love looks like. So let me give you what I believe is the true view. And this is a minority view. I admit that from the beginning. But it is one that has been taken by many throughout history. Here is what I believe this song is all about. I believe it's a song, indeed written by Solomon, describing godly love. But it's not about his love. It is a song where he is the bad guy because he had the wrong kind of love, foolish, worldly love. And in my judgment, that solves the problem of his extreme polygamy and physical emphasis where marriage is for pleasure or physical advancement. And why would Solomon write a book where he is the fool? Well, we already have a book like that. It's called the Book of Ecclesiastes. And so Proverbs gives us godly wisdom written by Solomon. Ecclesiastes gives us a godly perspective of what life is all about. And in my judgment, the Song of Solomon gives us the true perspective on godly love. As we go through the book, there are five characters that we might identify. There is the Shulamite girl, the woman who is the love interest in the story. There is her beloved, the shepherd boy. There is Solomon. There is the chorus that we would call, that are called the Daughters of Jerusalem, this female chorus. And there is what we might call a male chorus. It is her brothers. And her brothers are brought up at the beginning of the book in chapter 1 and verse 6, and then again at the end of the book in chapter 8, verses 8 and 9, kind of providing bookends for the song regarding her purity. Now, it's difficult, of course, for us to know who is speaking when, but it's not impossible. Raise your hand if you're reading out of the English Standard Version tonight. We have some ESV people in here tonight, just a few hands. You know, New King James, New American Standard, even the King James, a lot of times in the headings, they try and help us out by identifying who the characters are. I really like the English Standard Version because this is all the ESV does. It identifies the speakers as he, when it's dealing with masculine pronouns, as she, feminine, and then others when it's dealing with plurality. So that's either the Daughters of Jerusalem or her brothers who are speaking. And so if you read in an English Standard Version, it has those headings above each section. So if you know it's a man speaking, a woman speaking, or a group of people speaking. And from that perspective, I think we can start to piece together what this book is really all about. Let's look back in chapter 1. I think the theme of the book is found right at the beginning. Let's read verses 2 through 4 together. Let him kiss me with the kisses of his mouth. For a long time, that was the only verse I knew out of Song of Solomon, because it was really popular when I was in college that people were saving any kissing until marriage. And so I'd just quote this verse at them, and they'd get really annoyed by that. Now, I had to grow beyond that understanding, right? For your love is better than wine. Your anointing oils are fragrant. Your name is oil poured out. Therefore, virgins love you. Notice verse 4, which I believe is the theme of the book. Draw me after you. Let us run. The king has brought me into his chambers. To me, that shows us right from the very beginning that we have these three main characters. Draw me after you. Let us run together. The king has brought me into his chambers. The key to my understanding is when I realized that Solomon was not the beloved. Her beloved is a shepherd boy, not the king of Israel. This is on your handout, so you see these references. I'll just ask you, I even put on the handout, you can circle yes or no to this question. Do the descriptions of the beloved and the Shulamite seeking him, does this sound like Solomon and her descriptions of the man that she loves? Let's just go through and read these really quickly. Chapter 1 and verse 7. I actually read this on accident, so this should sound familiar, right? Tell me, you whom my soul loves, where you pasture your flock, where you make it lie down at noon. For why should I be like one who veils herself beside the flocks of your companions? David started out as a shepherd. Solomon wasn't a shepherd a single day in his life. He was a prince raised in a palace, and yet she describes her beloved in these terms. And maybe you say, well, that's poetic language, and certainly that argument could be made were it not for the rest of the evidence we see throughout the book. Let's drop down to chapter 2 and verse 4. He brought me into the banqueting house, and his banner over me was love. And it seems as though what's described here is a local banquet that would have been common in the ancient world. It's a date, if you want to put it in those terms. And this I know. I know very little about the politics of kings and queens and those sorts of things. But I do know this. It's pretty rare for a king to go on a date at a local banquet. And yet that's what's being described there. Go to chapter 3 and verse 3. Chapter 3 and verse 3. She says, the watchmen found me as they went about the city. Have you seen him whom my soul loves? She asks. She was asking that of Solomon. It doesn't make a lot of sense. She goes to the watchman. Have you seen Solomon? Yeah, up at the palace. What are you doing here, right? Let's go to chapter 5 and verse 2. I slept, but my heart was awake, a sound. My beloved is knocking. Open to me, my sister, my love, my dove, my perfect one, for my head is wet with dew, my locks with the drops of night. And it goes on to describe how eventually she goes to the door and goes outside, but her beloved is already gone. I want you to imagine for a moment King Solomon sneaking over to somebody's door and knocking on the door. Hey, are you home? Are you there? Again, that doesn't sound like kingly behavior. Drop down to verse 9. Others ask the question. The daughters of Jerusalem ask the question. What is your beloved more than another beloved? They ask her. O most beautiful among women, what is your beloved more than another beloved, thus that you thus adjure us? She's asking, where is my beloved? I want to find him. And there's like, what's so special about your beloved? If it's Solomon, what's the answer? I don't know, richest man alive, wisest man who ever lived. He's the most powerful man in the world. And yet, they ask the question, what's so great about your beloved? Let's go to chapter 6 and verse 1. Again, Solomon appears to be lost on this occasion. Where is your beloved gone, O most beautiful among women? Where has your beloved turned that we may seek him with you? Let's find him together as though he was lost. Again, the king of Israel would not be lost in such a way. And then I think perhaps the most clear verses in the whole book that shows Solomon is not the beloved is chapter 8, verses 11 and 12. Read these with me. We'll come back to these in the application here in just a moment. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He let out the vineyard to keepers. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. Yet she says, my vineyard is my very own, is before me. You, O Solomon, may have 1,000 and the keepers of the fruit of 200. And so she says there of Solomon, look, my vineyard is my own. You've got a lot, and you can have them, but you can't have mine. Again, her beloved is this shepherd boy. I would encourage you to go and read the book straight through, especially out of the English Standard Version, and try and see the story. But I believe the basic story is this. Listen carefully, if you would please. During the days of Solomon, there is a beautiful blue-collar girl with protective older brothers. who is from this small town in northern Israel called Shunem. Those overprotective brothers all warn her to keep her love and purity till the right time for the right person when she is married. She is in love with a shepherd boy, and they are engaged to be married. As young couples in love are known to do, we see them going on a date in the town to the town banquet, lying down in a forest meadow, looking at the sky, getting in some kisses, even sneaking out in the middle of the night to see each other and getting caught by the town watchman, and generally wondering why they can't be together more than they are. These two young people are struggling somewhat to control their passions during their engagement, but they are both committed to maintaining their purity. But King Solomon has somehow heard about this beautiful girl, called the most beautiful among women, as we read in chapter 5 and verse 9. And he comes to this little town with all kinds of pomp and circumstance. He is carried along on a golden couch with purple cushions, with his crown on his head and 60 mighty men of war all around him. He sets up his tent in town and brings in this young lady. As Solomon obviously could, he waxes poetically about her beauty and her sexual appeal and says to her, chapter 4 and verse 9, "You have captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes." The town is obviously thrilled that Solomon has chosen one of their girls to be one of his wives. And it would certainly be good for everyone in town if she were to marry him. But the young girl loves the shepherd boy. And even in Solomon's presence, she thinks of him. That night, back at home, she hears her beloved knock quietly on her door and whisper to her. She gets up and goes to him, but he is already gone. So, like she has done before, she goes out looking for him. Only this time, the town watchmen rough her up a little bit and send her home. They can't have this little love story ruin the town's future relationship with the king of Israel. And so the girl goes home sick with love. The next day, she asks, "Why me?" when Solomon again describes her beauty in vivid metaphors. And he lets slip on that occasion that he already has 60 queens and 80 concubines back home, but he assures her, of all the virgins in the world, she is the only one for him. But in describing how he'd like to kiss her and more, he only reminds her of her beloved, the shepherd boy. She wants to go to her beloved and calls to him, but she struggles with the peer pressure of letting her whole town down. She wishes things were different. In the end, Solomon offers an impressive dowry for her hand, trying to buy her love, but that only makes her decision easier. She runs away with the shepherd boy and marries him and declares that her love is hers and she can give it to whomever she wishes. And she has kept the advice of her brothers in keeping herself pure. She was a wall with her love, not a door for any who wanted to enter, and it led her to true love. So Solomon records the story of the one who got away and what it taught him about real love. From this perspective, this is the main idea of the book. This is what Solomon wants us to do as he says and not as he did. Applying worldly physical standards and practices to dating and marriage can cause us to miss out on the better things that God offers us. Young people, did you hear that? I need you to listen to me. Applying worldly physical standards and practices to dating and marriage can cause us to miss out on the better things that God offers us. Solomon followed the path of all other physical kings who had the kind of power that he did. Kings in this day and age had many wives, and so did Solomon. Kings had harems to fulfill their desires, and so did Solomon. If kings heard about a beautiful woman, then they would go and find that beautiful woman and take her for themselves. Kings got what they wanted. But what did Solomon not have in following the physical path of physical kings? He missed out on the intimacy and love of an exclusive, committed relationship with someone else who feared God and God's way. You know, I said at the very beginning of the lesson, this do as I say, not as I do is maybe most detrimental coming from a pulpit in some ways. Maybe from parents it can be even more detrimental, but this idea of, you know, you got to listen to me, but I don't have to live it myself. I wish I could tell you, do as I do in every area of my life. You know, just imitate Reagan in all things and you're going to be great. I wish I could tell you that. I can't. But young people, when it comes to choosing a spouse, do as I did. I wish everyone had a marriage at least as good as Stephanie and mine. Not perfect, but I wish everyone had a marriage like ours. And it might surprise you to know, not everyone in my circle of friends and so forth liked Stephanie for me, thought she was the right girl for me. But I knew this. She checked some of the boxes that were important to me. You know, she was smart and funny and pretty and athletic and competitive and those sorts of things. But by far, most importantly, she was the most spiritually minded girl I had ever dated. Maybe the most spiritually minded girl I had ever known, at least among those who were around my age. She loved God. She was committed. Her faith was in Christ, and her faith was not going to be in me or anybody else. And so I encourage you to look for that and find that. Do what it takes, and don't settle for someone who checks some other boxes but doesn't love God with all of their heart, soul, mind, and strength. And that includes checking the box that says, well, they're a Christian, they say they are, or they come to church or whatever. No, you find somebody who loves God with all of their heart, soul, mind, and strength. Because that is the path, not just to heaven, but in receiving all of God's richest blessings in the marriage relationship. That's why this book is in the Bible, in my judgment. Now, in the time we have remaining, let's just make some practical applications that go along with that. Okay? Do as I say, not as I do. Five lessons on godly love. Number one, godly love begins with purity. Over and over, this theme comes up. We've already read some of those ideas, if not stirring up or awakening love until it pleases. I want you to just turn to chapter 8, if you would. Chapter 8 and verse 4, as we read a moment ago, I adjure you, O daughters of Jerusalem, that you do not stir up or awaken love until it pleases. Drop down to verse 8, if you would. Song of Solomon, chapter 8 and verse 8. These are her brothers who say, we have a little sister and she has no breasts. She's young. What shall we do for our sister on the day she is spoken for? If she is a wall, we will build on her a battlement of silver. But if she is a door, we will enclose her with boards of cedar. And so she responds to these protective older brothers and says, I was a wall, and my breasts were like towers. Then I was in his eyes as one who finds peace, who brings out peace, who brings out contentment. And that is contrasted with Solomon. Solomon had a vineyard at Baal Hamon. He let out the vineyard to keepers. Each one was to bring for its fruit 1,000 pieces of silver. But in regard to her purity, that's what the vineyard, that metaphor of the vineyard is. My vineyard, my purity is my very own. It is before me. You, O Solomon, may have the 1,000. I don't think it's coincidence that he had 1,000 women in his life. You may have the 1,000. You can have all those women you want, but you can't have me. And the keepers of the fruit of 200. Her vineyard was her own. And she says to those brothers, I have remained pure. I have not awakened love before the time that God says is right. And so, putting that in simpler terms, perhaps, I'd put it this way. We need to commit to devoted, monogamous purity no matter what. No matter what other people might say about us or to us, no matter how people treat us because of that, no matter what is placed before us, no matter how our spouse treats us, I will remain pure. And this decision needs to be made long before you find yourself in an emotional or enticing position. I know we've got some visitors from Lubbock tonight. I grew up in Lubbock. I grew up a Texas Tech fan. And you know what turned me against, not Texas Tech as a whole, but Texas Tech football in particular? I went to a game against Texas, the hated rival. Colt McCoy was the quarterback at the time.
And they chanted from the stands a vulgar insult about his purity. What do you do when others make fun of you for maintaining purity? You remember that this is something for you and God and your future spouse. Godly love begins with purity. And we have to have that commitment long before we find ourselves in some sort of position where that purity is going to be tested, before an image appears on the screen, before an interested friend or coworker crosses the line. And you don't have to be superhuman to do this. You have to be committed and spiritually minded and prepared. And it is wise to date people with that same kind of commitment and spiritual mindedness and to share that same commitment of purity with them. Make the determination now, I'm saving myself for my spouse, period. End of story. And as parents, we need to be talking about this kind of commitment with our children as well. And I will say this, if you've not done that, if you've already awakened love, to use the metaphor from Song of Solomon, the road is admittedly harder, but it doesn't mean that you can't begin now. God can certainly forgive you of anything that you've done, and any spouse that you really want to marry should be able to forgive you as well. So forgive yourself and then resolve from this point forward, I'm going to remain pure in the eyes of God. Godly love begins with that kind of purity. That's not what Solomon did, but I think that's what he tells us in this book. Secondly, and it goes right along with it, godly love is more than lust. I want you to turn to chapter 5 and verse 10, first of all. Chapter 5 and verse 10. We see that this is her talking. And she describes her beloved in physical terms. My beloved is radiant and ruddy, distinguished among 10,000. His head is the finest gold. His locks are wavy, black as a raven. His eyes are like doves beside streams of water bathed in milk, sitting beside a full pool. His cheeks are like beds of spices, mounds of sweet-smelling herbs. His lips are like lilies dripping liquid myrrh. His arms are rods of gold set with jewels. His body is polished ivory, bed-checked with sapphires. His legs are alabaster columns set on gold bases. His appearance is like Lebanon, choice as the cedars. His mouth is most sweet. He is altogether desirable. This is my beloved, and this is my friend, O daughters of Jerusalem. I want you to see that the idea of physical attraction is not unimportant. And it's not ungodly either. This is something that God designed in each one of us. And yet we need to understand that there should be more to our relationships than that. And certainly that's the case with her and her beloved. He is her closest friend. He is her most trusted confidant. Now you contrast that with Solomon and his descriptions. The first one is found in chapter 4, beginning in verse 1, this is right after Solomon arrives on the scene. Notice what he says in chapter 4 and verse 1. Beloved, you are beautiful, my love. Behold, you are beautiful. This is the very first thing that he says to her. All right, easy there, buddy. We just met, right? And so he begins to describe her beauty, and he describes her eyes and her hair and her teeth and her lips and her cheeks and her neck and her breast. He says in verse 7, you are altogether beautiful, my love. There is no flaw in you. Verse 9, you have captivated my heart, my sister, my bride. You have captivated my heart with one glance of your eyes, with one jewel of your necklace. This is the whole love at first sight, because sight is all there is in this description that he gives of her. And that's true in chapter 4. It's true again in chapter 6, verses 4 through 10. He describes her hair and her teeth and her cheeks. It's true again in chapter 7, in verses 1 through 9, her feet. And then he kind of gets a little bit more personal. Her thighs, her navel, her belly, her breast, her neck, her eyes, her nose, her head, her stature. And you notice I didn't read all of the descriptions, because all of the descriptions would look something like this, with the flock of goats and the towers and all those sorts of things. These are images. These are descriptions, and certainly not to be taken literally. But what's amazing to me is when he describes her, it's all about the physical.
It's all physical things that he describes. And he gets more and more explicit in his advances as the book goes on. This is worldly love. And I think it's especially ironic what we see there in chapter 6 and verse 9. Would you read that with me? Chapter 6 and verse 9. In verse 8, he says, there are 60 queens and 80 concubines and virgins without number. I've already got at home 60 queens and 80 concubines. There are virgins without number throughout the world, but my dove, my perfect one, is the only one of her mother, pure to her who bore her. The young women, listen carefully, the young women saw her and called her blessed. The queens and concubines also, and they praised her. Does that sound familiar at all? That is a direct echo of Proverbs 31, verses 28 through 31, of the worthy woman, the woman of virtue. And Solomon, despite his best efforts, has stumbled upon the right kind of woman whose worth is far above rubies because of who she is, not what she looks like, and all he can talk about is what she looks like. Young men, we need to learn from Solomon's mistakes. We need to learn from what he has done and know and see that physical attraction is important, but it is only a small part of the full picture of what godly love really is. I would say this, number three, godly love cannot be bought. In chapter 3, verses 6 through 10, it describes Solomon's wealth. And then if we go to chapter 8, let's read verses 6 and 7. We've read 10 through 12 a couple of times already about Solomon's vineyards and all those sorts of things. But notice what she says beginning there in verse 6. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy is fierce as the grave. Its flashes are flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord. Many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. Listen, if a man offered for love all the wealth of his house, he would be utterly despised. Solomon rented his literal and symbolic vineyards for personal gain. But she will not sell herself for all the wealth of Solomon. He has his vineyards, but she will not add her vineyard to the list. She said to Solomon, you can keep your money. My love is mine. Now that's a girl who knows her true worth. And so I would make this application. You say, all right, so you make an application to dowries now, Reagan. Where are we going with this? Don't give away love for what you think you can gain by giving it away. Solomon did that. It became a bargaining chip for him to expand his kingdom and expand his pleasure. And it cost him more than he ever imagined it would cost him. And too many today sell out their love for what they think they will get from it. Not in a literal financial sense, perhaps, although with some of the websites that are out there today, many are doing that, selling that in a literal sense. But many, even who claim to be Christians, sell their love nonetheless. I will gain this momentary pleasure that I've been missing out on if I give up my love. He or she will stay with me because they threaten to leave me if I give away my love to them. This is a way, by giving away my love, that I can be noticed and valued, even if I'm noticed and valued for my body instead of my mind or my heart. And whether it is with someone or on the internet or just in the way we dress daily, we shouldn't sell our love. Young ladies, let me speak to you specifically for just a moment. You are worth so much more than that. And there is so much more to you than just the way you look. And on the other side of the coin, no one has the right to take your love. It is yours to give. And if someone pressures you to give your love or tries to take it against your will, you should run from that person because that means they don't deserve your love. If they are trying to pressure you into giving it away. Godly love cannot be bought. It can only be freely given. Number four, godly love demands exclusive commitment. It's not what we read earlier with all the concubines and wives.
Instead, it's what we read in chapter 2 and verse 16, for example. She says, "My beloved is mine, and I am his." My beloved is mine, and I am his. Go to chapter 6 and verse 3. "I am my beloved's, and my beloved is mine. He grazes among the lilies." Go to chapter 7 and verse 10. "I am my beloved's, and his desire is for me." And then again, as we read in chapter 8 and verse 6, that love is as strong as death, jealousy is fierce as the grave. This idea of healthy jealousy, of true jealousy, that you adore someone, and you have to set a seal upon your heart and on your arm that this is exclusive, that this is sealed for one and no other. And so godly love expects this kind of exclusive commitment. And I would say there is an expectation of exclusivity, of commitment and possession with real love. This is not something that is open. And that includes our actions, yes, but also our eyes and our thoughts and our emotions. We need to be wholly devoted to our spouse and to our spouse alone. And it's okay to be jealous, not in the untrusting sort of way, but in the way that says, you are the most important person in the world to me, and I demand to be the most important person in the world to you. That we are one flesh with one another, and I will not break that bond ever. And then finally, my last application would be this, that godly love brings peace, and godly love brings contentment. Notice what happens there in verse 5 of chapter 8. Who is that coming up from the wilderness, leaning on her beloved? Again, that's symbolic of marriage. "Under the apple tree, I awakened you." Now, it talked about don't awaken love until it pleases. Now, they're married, and love has been awakened. "There, your mother was in labor with you. There, she who bore you was in labor. Set me as a seal upon your heart, as a seal upon your arm, for love is as strong as death. Jealousy is as fierce as the grave. Its flashes are the flashes of fire, the very flame of the Lord." And this flame burns so brightly that many waters cannot quench love, neither can floods drown it. That is the kind of love that God can offer. I like the way Garrett puts it in his, not G-Man Garrett, there's a biblical scholar, last name Garrett, who says in his commentary, "Song of Solomon presents sexuality as a good thing protected by marriage, not as an evil thing made permissible by marriage." And so I would leave you with this. This relationship, when saved for marriage, brings peace and the removal of angst. But this relationship, the same relationship outside of marriage, causes uncertainty and guilt and betrayal. Another way of putting it, God's way is the best way. God's way works. God's way is worth it, and beware the lies of the devil. Well, that could be applied to anything, couldn't it? And that's what the writings of Solomon say over and over and over again. Do as I say, not as I do, but fear God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of man. Do as I say, not as I do, but God's way works, and beware the lies of the devil. And that applies not just to this relationship, but to all things that we might do in this life, all things that pertain to life and godliness. And if we can help you this evening to find God's way, to do things God's way, or even come into a relationship with Christ as Christ has intended by putting Christ on in baptism, or if you want help in your fight against the devil where we can pray for you and pray with you, won't you come now while together we stand and while we sing?
What can what go?